Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. Today we are going to be talking with Francis DeLuca of the Civitas Institute about the conservative action rankings released this week by the Civitas Institute, ranking North Carolina legislators in the House and Senate on their conservatism. Then we are going to talk with Dr. Bob Lipke, policy director for the Civitas Institute, about a recent article he published on the Civitas Institute website. Then we will finish up with Demi Dowdy, also of the Civitas Institute as well, bringing us the media meltdown, giving us the top five outlandish, crazy, unreasonable things Dr. William Barber, head of the North Carolina NAACP, has said, all of it on the record. So make sure you hang around and catch that part of the show right at the end. I want to thank all the listeners for coming back for another week. And if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, do that wherever you listen to podcasts by searching What Matters in North Carolina, or follow us on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC. Now we will roll right into Francis DeLuca talking about the Civitas Action Conservative Rankings.
All right, we have Francis DeLuca joining us now, president of the Civitas Institute, here to give us an update on things going on.
And Matt, I'm the president of Civitas Institute, but I also wear a different hat. I am the president of Civitas Action. And if the listeners are interested, this website is civitasaction.org. Civitas Action is what's known as a 501c4, sometimes called social welfare organizations, but they are nonprofits that are allowed to do a few more things. What our Civitas Action does is we score legislators on their voting. We score them on a conservative effectiveness. In other words, when we're done, we give them a score from 0 to 100, depending on how they vote on votes. And at civitasaction.org, you can not only see the votes for this year in 2017, you can see votes for other years, and you can see the lifetime scores of legislators past and present, and especially the people serving now. We maintain all those scores. And we first started doing this, I'll give you a little background on the conservative effectiveness rankings by Civitas Action. And we've been doing the scoring since 2008. The website currently has all the scores to 2011, because when we transitioned to a new site to start doing the updated lifetime scores, we lost some of the old votes. We're putting those in as we can get them back. But it is the only rating system in North Carolina that allows the citizens of the state of North Carolina to determine how their representative are actually voting on a broad range of important bills. And these are, they vote all the time. Most of the bills really don't have an ideological influence to them. They're things to name streets. They're things to allow cities to do things which only the legislature can allow them to do. A number of little things like that, bills that honor people or honor sports teams. But there are a number of bills that have significant philosophical leanings. So we try and determine on those bills that where you can determine, is this a conservative? Is this a liberal? Is it a what we would call a good conservative position? We have a few basic principles for determining that. We score votes on bills where we're able to clearly determine a conservative liberal tilt. And let me give you a couple of examples of bills that would do this. And any bills that would increase regulation, taxes, or spending would be bills we would definitely grade in. Or if they would cut regulation, taxes, or spending, we would grade those. It just depends on which they do as to how we grade them. If they're conservative, that's a good vote. If they're not conservative and you vote for them, that's a bad vote. So one of the things we would grade, any bills to require to do a business that previously did not require one. In other words, if you're doing something, suddenly the state comes along and says, oh, well, you have to have a state-issued license to do what you're doing. And I'll give you two examples of bills that did that in the recent past. These all both came in just in the past couple of years. One was to do hair braiding. Hair braiding used to be done by women mostly from either Africa or the Caribbean that would braid other women's hairs. And someone came up with the bright idea that, well, we should license those people. We shouldn't just let them do that, because who knows what terrible things would happen. So That is now where those women who would do that with little formal education now have to have a state-issued license, have to pay for it. That is what we call a barrier to entry into a profession. And it's what keeps mostly poor and less educated people from advancing in life. And so we consider that a bad thing. It's not very conservative to keep people from doing what they want to do in the business world if they're not hurting anybody. The other one, another bill that is an example of a licensure bill that we actually did grade in the last couple of years, landscaping contracting. So if you hire someone to do your yard, they now have to have a license issued by the state. So, you know, it's to protect the health and safety and the look of the state, I guess, is what it is. You know, you can't have unlicensed landscape contractors running around messing up people's yards. And while I don't want anybody's yards messed up, I think most people would probably get references or look at other people, see them doing your work or word of mouth. In other words, I'm not going to recommend to my neighbor that they hire someone who I had a bad experience with. But guess what? If they're licensed by the state now, you not only have your sign you hang out, you have your state sanction that you do a good job. That's how I think most people interpret licensing. So one of the big areas where we're always having to fight is the increasing number of professions that you have to be licensed to practice. North Carolina in the nation has one of the highest number of professions that you have to have a state license. So we're not talking about things, you know, most people would look at doctors and things like that. North Carolina is well into the 50s, approaching 60 different things. If you want to do it, you have to have a state license. And again, in the nation, I believe, last time I checked, that was in the top 5 of the nation in terms of number of licenses. We also grade any budgets, and we tend to grade them. If they increase spending more than population or inflation, we would say that's bad. If they increase spending less than population inflation, that's good. If they decrease taxes, that's good. If they increase taxes, that's bad. And I want to explain a little more about taxes, because sometimes, and especially in the budget bills, there are good and bad things. All budget bills pretty much increase spending because the state is growing in population, inflation is happening, so you tend to spend more money every year, regardless of how good you try and do. We believe you could actually cut the budget in North Carolina, but unfortunately, most legislators don't tend to agree with that. They think you got to spend more. But in terms of tax cuts, you may have a bill that lowers the personal income tax level, but may expand the sales tax to a few more products. We would still, if the overall level of taxation was less, in other words, if, let's say, they lowered total income tax collections by $100 million, but they increased the sales tax collection by $50 million, that would still be a net tax cut of $50 million. So we would call that a good vote.
So I have a question in that vein. If they, let's say there was a net difference, so no net difference tax change, and they went from taxing an income level tax to a consumption tax, could that be a good vote?
Good question, Matt. So that is a good question. So let's say tomorrow they eliminated the personal income tax, and they expanded sales tax to cover enough different things that it covered the amount of revenue lost by the income tax. We would grade that a good vote because we as a organization believe philosophically that it is better to tax consumption than it is to tax production. And when we say production, we mean everybody listening to this probably has worked for a living, whether it was run their own business or they work for the government or they work for a private business, they earn money. They did something to earn that money. That is productive work. And so we feel that you should encourage people to do productive work. And by taxing them less, you were encouraging that more. Now, on the other hand, government has to get money. So we think that if you treat all classes of things the same in terms of sales tax, that is a good thing, because then pretty much makes it neutral. You've got to do something. Do you hire someone to cut your yard, or do you buy a lawnmower? If you buy a lawnmower, you pay sales tax. If you hire someone to cut your yard, you don't pay sales tax. So you're making a decision how you make money, how you spend your money, and we think you should treat all the different activities the same. But you have no choice on how you earn your money if you work with your hands for a living. And when I say hands, that could be you write a newspaper, you know, you write an article for a newspaper, you sell something at a store, you type on a computer, whatever it might be, that is working for a living. The people who, you know, clip coupons, as they used to say, who are passive investors, don't work for a living. That's a whole different set. But the North Carolina income tax taxes people for working for a living. So that's where we think we would like to see no income tax on both personal and corporate. And on that note, corporate income tax is actually paid by individuals, be they, you know, because the corporations always include the cost of that in the products you buy. So there, you know, you're paying that tax whether or not you think so. And if you happen to invest in your 401k or in an IRA, or you own stock yourself, you are paying that corporate income tax because in the terms of lesser return. So that would be the tax question. I think that answers your question on the taxes, right?
Oh, definitely. And whenever you're talking about consumption tax versus an income tax, I always think about New York and their cigarette tax. And the reasoning behind the cigarette tax is to get people not to smoke, to make people not want to smoke because it's expensive.
Perfect example.
So what is the reasoning behind an income tax?
Yeah, there's always been this saying, if you want less of something, tax it. So why are we taxing income? We want more income. And that is, so a good point. And one of the things they have found, though, there is a limit to what you can tax something in terms of your return. There is a, you know, there's a curve. The more you tax, the more you get until you get to a level that causes less. And states like New York have seen that with the cigarette tax. They raised it so high, people now don't buy cigarettes in New York. They go to the neighboring states to buy cigarettes, or they order them through the mail or something to avoid paying the cigarette tax. And they've actually seen their revenue fall off of cigarette taxes. And across the country, there's, you know, as cigarette taxes have produced less revenue than they anticipated in a lot of places. So the other kind of broad category of bills we tend to grade are mandate bills. Bills that mandate something of private citizens or of businesses. And I'll give a couple examples of that, because this is one that's always kind of controversial. But the legislature almost every year introduces a new insurance mandate. They require the insurance companies to do something, be it cover a specific kind of treatment or to treat drugs a certain way. And what this is basically doing is telling a private organization, an insurance company, which is dealing with private citizens, this is how you're going to conduct your business. But what it effectively does is it raises the cost of that product for everybody who buys it. And one of the reasons we have the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is that insurance had gotten more and more expensive because we continued at the state and national level to require it to do more things. And really a mandate is just a tax without the government actually having to spend the money. It does. It forces other people to tax the people. So I require an insurance company that tells them, guess what? You're going to pay for everybody's haircut. I'm bald. I don't need a haircut. But guess what? Because my insurance now pays for haircuts, I have to pay a higher premium to cover everyone else's haircuts. So, you know, that is kind of the essence of a mandate on an insurance payment. But the over the years, insurance mandates and higher cost of insurance and people not being happy with it was what led to kind of the critical mass where our U.S. representatives thought they could change the insurance system wholesale without taking into account the impact of it. The other kind of I'll give you another example of a mandate bill. In fact, two of them. One happened back in 2007. It's what's called Senate Bill 3 here in North Carolina. They mandated the use of renewable energy in North Carolina. We're the only state in the Southeast that mandates renewable energy. We mandated that the utility companies buy renewable energy. Well, the reason they mandated it is because the utility companies weren't doing it, and there's a reason. it costs more money to have renewables in the system. But they said, we don't care, do it. And the electric customers, you out there listening, you'll just have to pay higher rates for this renewable energy. And the people who were the beneficiaries of this were not the customers, not you and me. The beneficiaries were the companies that produced the renewable energy. They were guaranteed a market. And over the last few years, the literally billions and billions of dollars in North Carolina have been transferred from taxpayers and from electric customers into the pockets of a handful of renewable energy companies in North Carolina. We have figured it's probably in excess of $4 billion directly. And that's not even, that's in excess of what should have been done. And think about that. If I could get someone to say, hey, Francis, you want to start a business? We'll make sure that you have like $4 or $5 billion worth of customers out there, and they don't, and there's no choice. They have to give you the money. That's what we would call a mandate, and that's why we think those things are bad.
So, in that same issue, wouldn't it then reduce the need to advance that technology? I mean, why do I need to build a better mousetrap if you're already telling me I've got a guaranteed market for my mousetrap?
And one of the problems with government interference with the system is exactly that. You kind of tend to freeze in place where you are as opposed to innovation technology. And in North Carolina, the renewable is solar. That's what it is. It's almost 100% solar. We have really no other wind power or anything like that, or innovative new kinds of energy, geothermal or anything. It's all solar. And so what we have done now is we are saddling the electric users in North Carolina with about the next 10 to 15 years. They're going to be paying higher solar rates, because the fact is that the technology is advancing, but we're going to be stuck with all this solar that's being installed now that did not wait for the technology to advance, did not wait for storage technology to advance. We're going to have this stuff on the system. And as a result of that, we had a bill this year that we graded. House Bill 589 was one of the bills we graded. And that was a bill that not only extended the requirement to expand solar by another, almost doubling it in the next couple of years from what we have now. So that's more customers for the solar people. It included instituting a subsidy program where rebates and for solar customers. So in other words, now not only are you paying higher rates, but if you don't use solar, you're subsidizing the people who do use solar, because they're not only going to get their power help paid for, they're going to get direct rebates for installing it. So we graded House Bill 589 as a bad vote if you supported that, and both House and Senate people did support that, so we graded that. Again, I want to tell CivitasAction.org. People can go look at all these votes. They can see the bills regraded. And before I go any further, I want to talk about actual kind of scores and everything. And again, the scores this year were very, you know, the whole range of everything. But what I did is I looked at how people did in the House and the Senate by party. But the let me tell you, in the House, the range of scores was from 8.3% up to 100%.
8.3%.
Yeah, that means a legislator voted right 8.3% on the...
I would be grounded until I was 30.
Actually,
if I was a high schooler getting that kind of progress report.
Well, let me go ahead and give you some things, and then we can talk about that. So that was a Democrat. That was he was the lowest Democrat in the House, John Autry of Mecklenburg County. He was at 8.3%. His constituency might like that, because they may not be very conservative. That might be a liberal constituency. They may think it's great that we said he was one of the worst legislators and he was one of the worst. Now, it's interesting, because Darren Jackson, who is the House Minority Leader, he's a Democrat, the Republicans control the House. Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, was the second lowest in the whole legislature. 120 members, he was second lowest at 15.4%. So he voted really right on one more bill than Autry did. So, you know, very much probably he, Darren Jackson, the House Minority Leader, is at the bottom of his caucus in terms of conservative liberal. Now, since I'm in that, I'll tell you, on the highest Democrat in the House was William Brisson of Bladen County at 62.9. He was higher than a lot of Republicans. He was right in the smack in the middle of a whole lot of Republicans at 62.9. And the lowest House Republican was Nelson Dollar of Wake County at 53.8. So you've got this kind of range of Republicans from 53.8 and Nelson Dollar of Wake County up to the highest House member was 100%, one person, and that's Chris Millis of Pender County. And
that makes a lot of sense knowing some of the things he's been pushing.
Yeah, well, Chris is a consistently conservative member. We like Chris Millis. We think he's very conservative. He's usually right on the issues. We can tend to bet that if we don't know what an issue is and he votes for it, we kind of look at it and figure out which way it is. That's not what we do, but I think you could almost set your conservative watch by Chris Millis. Now, so I kind of went through the House. Those were the people. And the House doesn't have a majority leader. They have a speaker, and that would be Tim Moore. And interestingly enough, Tim Moore's score is 69.2. So that put him at the lower end of House Republicans. And remember, I told you that William Brisson was at 62.9, so he was a little higher than a Democrat.
So knowing how the House Speaker usually doesn't vote on a lot of issues, does that hurt his score?
We have to only go by what he votes. So the ones he decides not to vote in, they just he is punished. He loses for not voting. He makes choices. If he didn't vote in any, we wouldn't grade him. But since he votes in a number of bills, we have to grade him right and wrong.
So if he had done nothing, he'd be better off, which Tillis, when he was a speaker, did, I would say, less
closer
voting.
It was interesting. As he got closer to election time, he would vote more when he ran for U.S. Senate. But that's another issue. In the Senate, it's different because Phil Berger, the Senate President Pro Tem, votes on every vote. And in his case, he had an 88.9. So that put him in the upper half of Senate Republicans. He was not the highest. There were five Senate Republicans who had 100. And I could give you the names, but I'm probably not going to try.
They'll have to go to Civitas Action.
Yes, civitasaction.org. There were also five Dems who tied for the highest of the Democrats, and they were at 22.2.
So on the whole, there seems to be more division between the Senate and the House, aisles.
Yeah, let me give you one more. The lowest Democrat, or the Dan Blue, who is the Senate Minority Leader, Senator Blue, he tied at 11.1 with four others for the lowest score. So their Minority Leader on both the House and the Senate was very much at the liberal end of the spectrum. The Senate leader was at the conservative end of his spectrum. The Republican leader in the House, who is the Speaker, was at the more liberal end of the legislature. I did not look at the majority leader in the House. I should have looked at that. I did not. But if you go to civitasaction.org, you can look up the majority leader and see.
They can run all the numbers they want to.
They can look at all the scores. They can look at this year. They can see the votes. They can see all the votes, the bill descriptions of them. They can do anything they want, and they can actually look past it, do averages. This year, we found that the Senate average was higher than last session, but the House average dropped, which means that the Senate voted a little more conservatively, in our opinion, than last year, but the House a little less conservatively than that year. And that's really one of the valuable things here. We see big trends, not just one vote. And we try and look at, as I said, trends across a broad spectrum of bills, not a narrow thing. We just don't grade fiscal. We don't grade social, just social. We grade any bill that comes across that we can define an actual ideological spread.
You really get to kind of take a temperature of the House and Senate over time and see where they're really going.
And the individual legislators, because we track it over time, so we get to see how they go. And what we tend to see in some legislators who are not either real conservative or real liberal, as their time in the legislature goes on, they tend to move in a more liberal direction. I'll just make that as a kind of a blanket statement. Not true in every case, but in a lot of cases it is.
It's very interesting.
Well, again, if the listeners are interested, civitasaction.org. They've got any questions, they can email us here at Civitas, and we're happy to answer them. And I hope you'll go check it out and find out what your legislator is doing.
All right. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
Always good to be here.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com. Or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polscher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Joining us today in What Matters in North Carolina is Dr. Bob Libke, Director of Policy for the Civitas Institute, and he's here to talk about how the attacks on the UNC litigation reforms are a weak attack. So, Bob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm doing well, Matt. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. So talk to us. Tell us, what's the overview of this issue? You have an article that you wrote on the Civitas Institute website about this topic, but tell us, what is the elevator pitch? What's going on?
Well, let me give you a little relevant background on this. Our audience are usually pretty well up on the news. Let me give you a little kind of a thumbnail of what the article's about. Some of you may remember that earlier this year, there was a proposed UNC resolution that would prohibit any UNC centers or institutes from participating in litigation. That caught a lot of attention initially. As you might expect, people on the left were incensed that it might close down the UNC Center for Civil Rights, which a lot of people on our side believe also that it's functioning essentially as a public interest law firm. And the motivation behind the proposal, which was put forward by one of the Board of Governors, whose name was, I believe, Joe Knott, he had said he wanted to put it forward with so that it would put more of a greater focus on academics in the institutes and the centers, and that was his goal in putting this forth. Now, when I believe it was February when the initial idea was floated, there were a couple months where there were a number of articles in the paper where people who were criticized the proposal said that it would threaten a lot of institutions their accreditation. Accreditation is basically a stamp from a private body, an organization that says you've met our standards. It's kind of a good housekeeping seal of approval on academics, institutional governance, finance, etc. People that were opposed to the measure said it would threaten the accreditation of law schools and possibly the institution in general. And if some of you remember, the Chapel Hill campus actually was on probation for a couple of years because of the recent athletic scandal. They just got off of it, and based on timing, it would not be a good thing to do.
So how would it threaten the accreditation of an institute to tell them that they can't go out and litigate? This is a place for learning, not action. How does that threaten?
Well, if you look at the argument they're trying to say is that it would close off this opportunity for law school students to participate in this particular opportunity. Again, the UNC Center for Civil Rights provides opportunities for law school students to actually take on cases, you know, to write briefs, get courtroom experience, etc. If they lose that opportunity, which is part of accreditation, having access to opportunities such as this, they would, you know, not meet or not have the array of opportunities that the governing body, and in this case it'd be the ABA, you know, says that they actually need. Now, if you look at this, if you look on our side, of the, when I say people that have looked at that argument, it's weak. It's very weak because the fact of the matter is that you're only if the resolution is passed, at best you're only closing off one opportunity. There are ample opportunities that law school students have to get clinical experience, to do internships, to do participate in other ABA approved legal opportunities, such as the one at the UNC Center for Civil Rights. So when they say it would threaten accreditation, I don't find that to be a believable argument, because you're really only closing off one opportunity of an array of opportunities. And if that's the case, it's likely it shouldn't impact accreditation at all.
So, and then on the other side, it's sort of like saying that, you know, I'm a newspaper guy. So it's like saying that my university newspaper shut down, but also I have opportunities to intern with other newspapers out there. So there's other ways of getting that experience. Like you said, clerking for a law student.
That's right.
There's other ways to get that experience, right. But the argument is, why shut this down? So I guess is that a way of summarizing or relating it to another thing?
Yeah, I think if I'm arguing it from the other side, that I mean, the biggest problem is that there are other options available. And since that's the case, it really undermines the argument, because it doesn't threaten accreditation at all, because the same experience, the same work experience, the same opportunities to get courtroom experience is available through other opportunities. So it's the argument that it's going to threaten accreditation is, I mean, it's an untenable argument.
It just seems very unrelated to me. It seems a really far logic leap to say that shutting down one program, essentially one activity of one part of this institution, can threaten the institution at large, the law school or wider. It seems really just illogical. Just to me, not a law student, never a law student, not a lawyer, it seems illogical to me.
I would call it melodramatic. It's being done because I think in the policy arena, what's happening is people that are against this resolution are trying to motivate their base, and one of the tripwires that gets the base motivated is if there's anything that will impact academic integrity, academic quality, it is, you know, accreditation, a loss of accreditation. So that card is being played, but what I'm saying is it's not being played very well because of the circumstances of the actual policy. And the other thing that's important to realize here is accreditation, I mean, it's an issue that actually has been in the news, in and out of the news, for a lot of the last 7 or 8 years for a number of reasons. If people remember, especially those of us that have lived in Wake County, if you remember back to 2011-2012, Advanced Ed, which is the umbrella group of 4 or 5 regional national accrediting agencies in the United States. Advanced Ed, which is, I mean, you can basically say they're the largest accrediting body in the world. Let's call them the Microsoft of accrediting agencies. They're based in Atlanta. But if you remember, when the Republican majority of the Wake County School Board had passed, had reversed the resolution on, reversed the policy on school busing for diversity purposes, et cetera, there was a big uproar about the potential loss of accreditation. Advanced Ed, their accrediting body from Georgia, had come up here. There was a lot of saber rattling. They had come in, they had observed the board's meetings and governance and so forth. And long and short of it, the body was not put on probation, but I guess it came in, Advanced Ed came in from their perspective, basically kind of show that other people are watching and that they're involved. And this is, you know, what's open to debate. They're involved with more than just academics, but they also believe that they're part of accreditation involves how governing bodies actually govern and address policy issues. Now, that is the other part of this, that there's a lot of contentious discussion over, and where even within, if we get back to the UNC issue, there was a seven-page memo drafted by Judith Wegner, who is the former law school dean of UNC Chapel Hill. And she had put together a memo that was sent to all members of the UNC Board of Governors stating her opposition to this proposal and the adverse impacts of it. And she, if I boil down a lot of it, it comes down to two things, which is she believes that accreditation will be threatened, and I disagree with that stance based on what we had said before. But she had also said that in this particular case, the boards of the members of the Board of Governors who are putting this policy forward are putting forward personal views, and that I'm paraphrasing her here, but the thinking on this, and I don't think she'd disagree with this, is that we have to regulate politics, and accreditation really needs to keep politics out of Board of Governors meetings, et cetera. And it's a different view on accreditation, which is, you know, accreditation is not involved with political influences, and it really tries to regulate the way in which these bodies should function. Now, and I know this is a long point, but this is the second thing. The first thing is, the first problem we'd have with accreditation is, one is it's not a valid indicator of academic quality. The second issue is, as we said before, is that we take issue with whether or not accreditation should be viewed as this black box, totally insulated from politics. Because if you look at reality, that's not the case.
Right. So looking from a totally, you know, not from the hysterical point of view of accreditation, but just from your point of view, what is the downside of dissolving the center, stopping the center from litigating? What is the logical downside?
Are you asking me to argue for the policy, or?
Well, I'm saying what is the negative? What is the negative of stopping this civil rights, the center, from litigating?
Well, let me state my views on this should be evident from what I said in the piece. You know, and I favor the actual argument put forward by the UNC Board of Governors that we shouldn't have a public interest law firm, you know, operating in the state, no matter on what side of the issue they're on.
You mean operating within the state as a part of the state?
Yes. I mean, right. Essentially, the entity can sue local government, they can sue state agencies, and it can actually get quite costly. But that's not the real reason to do it, but it creates a lot of conflicts of interest, and I don't think it's a good way of doing things. Now, what's the downside if I'm on the opposite side of the argument? And I'm arguing against this, I'd say that you shut down an opportunity for experience for these law school students. Granted, they can get the experience elsewhere, but you also will, you know, eliminate the opportunity for them to, you know, get working experience at essentially what functions as a public interest law firm. Now, what's never been stated and what's never been discussed at any Board of Governors meeting is this a desirable function? Is this something the state should be doing? And if you look at the real impact, the real aftermath of a lot of this, I don't think anybody had any idea that things were going to go in this direction. So I would agree with Mr. Knott, the gentleman who put forward the proposal initially, with the intent of trying to refocus, you know, the emphasis of centers and institutes more on academics and not on other issues, which, you know, the Civil Rights Institute is actually doing. I mean, those are policy issues, but they're not. The UNC ultimately the focus is academics.
Right.
It shouldn't be on policy issues. So.
All right. So what is the next step? What's going to happen next in this process?
Well, the next step is about a month ago, a committee of the UNC Board of Governors had recommended that the UNC put together four or five alternatives to the current policy to see, you know, what they could do to resolve the issue. That they met last Friday in Asheville, and they did not vote on the actual proposal, which was, are they going to prohibit centers and institutes from entering litigation? They didn't want to do that without voting on the five or six UNC alternatives. So they actually, I don't believe they did that at the meeting on Friday. So everything's about a month off. What they did on Friday last week was they had somebody, as I said before, from Advanced Ed come in, and it was a session on how the board, you know, should act on issues like this, not micromanaging and so forth. It seemed to be, in my view, a gentle reminder of not micromanaging things. And if I was a board member, I would have been slightly put off by it, but I'm not going to speak for them. But, you know, that's where things are at. The first thing is, as I said before, initially they have to vote on the proposal, but before they vote on the proposal, they also have to review five or six alternatives that the UNC system put together to see if they can work this out without, you know, totally shutting down the Civil Rights Institute. Now, a couple of those options were to spin it off into a private entity. There are other arrangements that are, you know, can be found in other documents, but they have not yet reviewed that, and I think before they have a vote, they will fully review what the existing alternatives are. There were a couple articles in the paper on it, but I think if you were someone that was against the existing arrangement, I don't think any of the alternatives would have been satisfactory for many of the people that would really want change in it.
All right, and as that goes, we're definitely going to want to bring you back on to give us an update as things are moving on. But thank you for joining us on What Matters in North Carolina. Thank you, and we'll make sure we have you back.
All right, good to be here, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day, Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com.
This is Demi Dowdy with the Civitas Institute. Today we're going to talk about Reverend William Barber. So Reverend William Barber, head of the North Carolina NAACP and Moral Monday March leader, has made any number of ridiculous claims and outrageous statements over the years. But lucky for you, I have compiled a list of a few of the top five most outrageous things that Reverend Barber has said or done. And there are many more, but let's just go through the top five. Number five, in an appearance on Bill Maher's show a few years ago, Barber claimed that Republican leaders in North Carolina are extreme and immoral, and Maher called them the bad guys who hijacked our state. He enjoyed a high five with Reverend Barber for that one, his clever comments about how backward Republicans are. Oddly enough, Barber and his cronies are the ones who still believe, against all scientific evidence, that a baby in the womb is not actually a life. So who's really backwards? Number four. In 2013, shortly after the election of North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory, Reverend William Barber announced that he and his followers had delivered a letter to the governor decrying Governor McCrory's signing of the bill that had repealed the Racial Justice Act. So here's an excerpt from the press release that Reverend Barber sent after delivering the letter. "We just delivered a letter to the governor and the speaker saying you've got the power to stop this. Just reconsider your attacks on Medicaid, voting rights, the unemployed, and the poor. If you don't, then we will probably escalate in some ways. I'm not going to say how, because what they're not going to do is live in peace while they hurt so many people and destroy so many lives." Number three, at a convention of far-left activists back in 2014, Reverend Barber told the audience that he was bothered by politicians citing freedom to campaign against an overreaching government. Indeed, Barber for years has lobbied for massive government programs under the cloak of justice while characterizing as immoral any talk of individual liberty. "Our deepest moral traditions declare that the true challenge of society is not private charity, but public policy that impacts how people exist every day of our lives," declared Barber. But apparently, morality and justice, according to Barber, can only be achieved through political means. Number two. On May 30th, 2017, this one you might have heard, Barber was arrested after refusing to leave the North Carolina State Legislative Building during a protest over healthcare legislation. Of course, the best way for a preacher to lead by example is to disobey basic laws. Number one, Reverend Barber recently said in an MSNBC interview, actually this week, that praying for President Trump borders on heresy. Clearly, Reverend Barber has not been reading his Bible. In 2 Timothy 2:1, Paul instructs us to pray for all people, for kings, and all who are in high positions. And strangely, Paul did not specify party affiliation, or even that we should only pray for leaders with whom we agree, or leaders that we like. So at best, Reverend William Barber misinterprets scripture and morality. At worst, he is blatantly manipulating the words of the Bible as a tool for his own political gain. He tends to use his title as a political weapon, throwing the word immoral around with a sense of authority, hoping it will stick to anyone with whom he disagrees politically. Furthermore, he and the NAACP also received generous funding from George Soros, the billionaire financier who backs so many left-wing groups. Could it be any more obvious that William Barber is not a sincere man of faith, but a political pawn of the left who uses the word of God to achieve political gains? As far as I'm concerned, that's the real heresy here.
All right. Thank you, Demi, and thank you to you, the listeners, and join us again next time on What Matters in North Carolina.